You pick up your Bible and wonder, is there more here than meets the eye? Is there anything here for me? I mean, it's just words printed on paper, right? Well, it may look like just print on a page, but it's more than ink. Join us for the next half hour as we explore God's Word together, as we learn how to explore it on our own, as we ask God to meet us there in its pages. Welcome to More Than Ink.
You know, sometimes we hear people say, I wash my hands of this thing. What do they mean by that?
Yeah, and that is such an unusual phrase. Where'd that come from?
Well, it's in our passage today.
Ah, that's right. Pontius Pilate. Okay, we'll read that together here on More Than Ink. And here we are. It's More Than Ink, and I'm Jim.
And I'm Dorothy.
And we're so glad that you're with us. We are reading through the Gospel of Matthew and coming pretty close to the end of it.
Well, yeah, and it's very seasonal that we would be talking about this because we have just or are just about to celebrate Good Friday and Resurrection Day.
Right, right. So this is timely stuff. Now, I've got to warn you, many times when we read these very familiar passages, and we're going to talk about the immediate steps leading up to the crucifixion, that we sort of gloss over mentally because we say, well, I've heard this
I know
before.
That story. Yeah.
Yeah, I heard that story. So the degree to which it's possible for you to sort of put off what you already know and listen to this and read this as though maybe you've never done it before. I know that's kind of impossible, but it's really helpful because what it does is it causes you to slow down and read with more insight and questioning to God as you're reading this rather than saying, heard this, go past it. Because there's more here than meets the eye.
Yeah, and one of the things that I typically do during Easter week is I try to read all four gospel accounts of in close proximity to one another. Mm-hmm. I have sometimes lined them all up on the same day, because that gives us a much more rounded picture of the events from all these four different perspectives.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that I have enjoyed doing that again this year. It's been very helpful.
Yeah, and it's always a good discipline when you're talking about narratives, which is storytelling about an actual event, because when you have different perspectives of witnesses who see this, they'll include different details, and they're not in conflict, but they actually complement each other. We've said that before, but it's always just a healthy thing when you read a passage here to read the parallel passages. Now, how can you in Bible study find where the parallel passages are?
Ooh, good question. Well, the really easy, low-tech way is because we know all four Gospels are aiming at the crucifixion and the resurrection, is to go to the very last chapter of each of the four Gospels and start turning pages back until you find the events of the crucifixion.
Right.
It'll be within the last couple of chapters.
It should be that
hard.
All
of the Gospels.
Yeah. Or if you want to do something that we've also recommended in the past, there's usually a column reference or a side reference on your Bible page, and that has references to other passages. And I bet you, sure as shooting,
they'll be there.
When you start into a certain section, they'll tell you where you can find this in the other Gospels. So take the time and do that. That's really valuable.
Okay, but we can just tell you right up front today, the passage we're dealing with today in Matthew 27, the parallel passage is in John 18, 28 to 40, and in Luke 23, 1 to 25.
Yeah. So save you the time.
Yeah. So, well, it's also in Mark, but Mark's is very much shorter.
Almost every time Mark is more abbreviated. So, well, let's just dive into it. We're in chapter 27, if you're following with us in Matthew, and we're coming into verse 11. Remind me again, what just happened last time we
did this?
Because
it starts with now Jesus stood before
the governor. Right, that's where I just realized.
Well, in the last couple of weeks, we saw Jesus standing before the religious authorities. So that was a couple of weeks ago.
Right.
And then just last week, we looked at Peter's denial.
Yes.
Which Matthew butts right up against Judas's betrayal.
Yes.
And the two men and their different responses.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where we left off. We left off with Judas throwing the money back in the temple and the religious authorities deciding to spend it to buy the potter's field as a burial place for strangers.
Yes.
And we talked about how ironic that was, that God in his gracious control made sure that the cost of the life of his son in money still went to care for people who had no one to care for them in their death.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a beautiful thing.
There's great theology there.
There really is, but we won't take time for that today.
We won't go too far. But to fill you in a little bit, Jesus has been arrested. He's actually, before we started into verse 11 here, chapter 27, he's already been to Pilate once.
Right.
And the first time he was there in Luke 23, you'll find it. And then he gets dragged to Herod. And then from Herod, he gets dragged back to Pilate.
Right.
And that's where we are today. He's back in front of Pilate. And we pick up the narrative in verse 11.
Yeah, Pilate's getting pretty exasperated by this time because he hasn't had his breakfast yet and he's irritated.
That's right. This is very early in the morning, okay. Way before his oatmeal. Yeah.
All right. So here we go. Verse 11 of chapter 27. Now Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And Jesus said, "You have said so." But when he was accused by the chief priests and elders, he gave no answer. Then Pilate said to him, "Do you not hear how many things they testify against you?" But he gave him no answer, not even to a single charge, so that the governor was greatly amazed.
Yeah, they were raising a lot of silly accusations.
Well, yes.
And so Pilate's trying to figure out why this guy is not defending himself. But he does directly answer, like he did with the high priest earlier, when asked, "Are you the king of the Jews?" He says, in very simple Greek as it's written here, "You say so."
That's right. The words have come out of your mouth.
Yeah. And this is exactly the same response he gave to the high priest in the previous chapter.
Mm-hmm.
Go check it out. It's in verse 64, the previous chapter.
Okay. And it's interesting that the chief priests are right there and they are accusing him. But Luke's gospel is the one that gives us their actual specific applications or accusations.
Right.
So I'll just read you from Luke 23, verse 2. "And they began to accuse him, saying, 'We found this man misleading our nation and forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar,'" which he did not,
mm-hmm.
"and saying that he himself is Christ, a king." So they're calling Pilate's attention to charges that can be chargeable in a Roman court of law. Yeah, because they know that just, you know, he's claiming to be God is not going to upset the Romans at all. Everybody claimed to be God. Everybody who ruled Rome said they were God.
But that strategy coming up with Roman civil code didn't work.
Nope.
It didn't work. In fact, it wasn't until Jesus just plainly straight out said that "I am indeed the king of the Jews. I'm the Messiah." And he says, yes. And so when he's brought here to Pilate, Pilate says, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And in fact, the way this is phrased, if you're watching a movie, you could sort of see Pilate sort of walking around Jesus and he looks at him, this guy who just looks horrible. Think what Jesus looks like at this moment. And he looks at him and almost with a scowl says, "You the king of the Jews?" Like,
right.
Almost as though he's saying, "This is the best.
This is the best you can do.
That the Jews can do." Something that looks like you. So there's a little bit of scorn here, but there's a lot of ridicule. And there's a little bit of irritation in how he says this. Like, "I got better things to do."
Right.
"You
Why
are
we
king?
Here?
Really? Really you?" So that's what he's saying right here. And then Jesus says, "Yep. Yep. Sulego, I am."
Yeah, and it's interesting that in Matthew's account, it says Jesus doesn't answer the chief priests and the elders, but he also doesn't answer Pilate.
Yeah.
But John's account, which may have been the other visit before Pilate, I didn't check
been.
That down.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
John's account in chapter 18, we, at this point in the conversation, he says, "Are you the king of the Jews?" This is John 18:34, and Jesus answered, "Are you saying this on your own initiative, or did others tell you about me?"
Right.
So he's
right.
Like, "Who's? Let's find out what this conversation is really about."
Yeah. Where's the charge coming from? Yeah.
So Pilate says, "I'm not a Jew. Did your own nation and chief priests deliver you up to me? What have you done?"
Like, and I don't
Jesus'
care.
Answer is very instructive still. He says, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would be fighting that I might not be delivered up to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not of this realm."
Right, right.
So Pilate says, "So you really are a king."
he is, but we don't have a conflict, is what Jesus
well,
is saying.
Well, yeah, Jesus said, "You say correctly that I am a king. For this I've been born, and for this I've come into the world, to bear witness to the truth.
Yep.
Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice."
Exactly. So he's not denying who he is.
No.
Every time he's asked who he is, he's been saying it straight up.
But it's helpful to read the whole conversation there
right.
and understand that it wasn't just two words to each other and we're done here. Right?
Exactly.
This was a full-flowered conversation.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I think part of Pilate's amazement at the end of verse 14 is the fact that Pilate has seen a lot of Jewish zealots.
Yeah, well, and he's put most of them to death.
And he's put a lot of them to death, yeah. And so, you know, Jewish zealots, they're courageous and strong and persistent and semi-nasty, you know.
Arrogant and abusive, yeah.
And if Jesus is one of those zealots, he's sure not acting like it here.
Yeah. That's why angry, I think, protesting their own innocence.
Yeah, I think that's why Pilate is greatly amazed, because all of these accusations are being made and Jesus does nothing to defend himself, but he speaks the truth about who he really is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's amazing. We should push on.
We should. Okay. So verse 15.
15.
Now, at the feast, the governor was accustomed to release for the crowd any one prisoner whom they wanted. Okay, I got to stop there for a minute, because the feast in view here is the Passover.
Passover.
Right? So
Passover.
We're hustling to get this done because it's the day of preparation and we got to be done here.
Right.
And the feast of the Passover is a celebration of the release of bondage for the Jews.
From Egypt.
So that's, from Egypt. So that's probably why they initiated this release, as a kind of a symbolic gesture. Yeah. Oh yeah, this is a party about release.
It's not in the Old Testament, but it's a tradition.
No, and it's something Pilate may even have instituted himself.
Yeah.
And then they had a notorious prisoner, this is verse 16, called Barabbas. So When they had gathered, Pilate said to them, "Whom do you want me to release for you, Barabbas or Jesus, who is called Christ?" For he knew that it was out of envy that they had delivered him up. Besides, while he was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent word to him, "Have nothing to do with that righteous man, for I've suffered much because of him in a dream."
Yeah, let's stop there for a second. So Barabbas is offered. This is an interesting pivot for Pilate, because what he's trying to do is sort of get out of this so he can get to his oatmeal.
Right.
You know, so what do you say? What do you say? I just got, release him to you. And he also,
Pilate, you made your point. Let's get on with it.
Yeah, Pilate also recognizes that it's the envy of the religious leaders, envy of Jesus' popularity, which is why they're doing this. So Pilate and the religious leaders were not friends. So in a way, this is a way of spiting him. Like they say, well, crucify him, and then Pilate finds a way by saying, I'll use this tradition, we'll get Jesus out, neener, 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 I don't have to do what you say. So it's an interesting pivot on his part to sort of preserve the peace and do something a little bit, in the face of the Pharisees is what he's doing. But he offers a guy Barabbas. And here we don't get the character study on Barabbas like we do in the other Gospels.
Well, we get a little bit, but there's more,
right?
Because Mark tells us that Barabbas was a murderer.
Yes.
John tells us that Barabbas was a robber.
Right.
And this passage will tell us that the chief priests had persuaded the crowd to ask for Barabbas and to destroy Jesus.
Yes.
Yeah. So murder, robbery, and destruction rang a bell for me. And in John 10:10, Jesus said, "Hey, the thief comes only to rob, steal, and kill, or to destroy."
Steal, kill, destroy.
Right?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So I want to circle back to that in a minute.
Yeah. Well, Barabbas, just as a little tidbit, also Barabbas is remarkably similar in sound to the phrase "son of the father."
Right. Well, that's actually, I think, what the meaning of the name is. Bar, son,
right.
Abbas.
Yeah, the actual phrase is a tiny bit different, but not much. There's enough for you to say, it sounds like he's the son of the father. What irony that he is being released instead of the real son
or
of the father.
He is the son of a father, right?
Yeah.
He's somebody's son.
Yeah.
And Jesus said to the Pharisees and the scribes, "You are sons of your father, the devil."
Right.
Right. So I noticed in this passage,
it's a great irony.
Close juxtaposition of the name Barabbas and Jesus, who is called the Christ, right? So Jesus, meaning Yeshua, right? God saves the anointed one, the real guy, juxtaposed with the imitator or the son of the devil.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Who do you choose?
Interesting trade. Tons of irony here.
Oh, yeah.
And then what do you make of the fact that Pilate's wife comes to him and says, "Look, I've had this dream. You need to disassociate.
Isn't that interesting?
You need to just get rid of this guy." Yeah.
And I don't know that we have any indication that Pilate ever would listen to his wife anyway.
Well, but she said, "For I have suffered much because of him." Boy, it was a disturbing dream. It was a stark warning that's just made her messed up all day long. I can't remember most of my dreams, but I never have one that makes me suffer all day long.
Well, and here's a little, she probably just woke up because this is early.
It's early. Oh, that's
right?
True.
And the dreams you remember are the ones you had right when you're waking up.
Right, right. And she goes looking for him. He's not in the palace. He's here in the business place. And she says, I had a dream about this guy.
Oh, no.
Yeah, you need to just get out of this. Yeah, interesting thing. So now Pilate's been warned, you know, and he's looking for reasons to let Jesus go, which is a fascinating change in character for him based on his reputation we read about. So in 20, let's see how this actually goes down, how he announces this, how it works out.
Okay. Now the chief priests and the elders persuaded the crowd to ask for Barabbas and to destroy Jesus.
Mob control. You notice this?
We don't know how they persuaded the crowd.
We do
but
not
somehow
know.
They did it. The governor again said to them, which of the two do you want me to release for you? And they said, Barabbas. Pilate said to them, then what shall I do with Jesus who is called Christ? And they all said, let him be crucified. And he said, why? What evil has he done? But they shouted all the more, let him be crucified.
Okay, weird.
Yeah.
I mean, Pilate's trying to let this guy go. He's trying to use his pivot gambit to release the traditional prisoner, which would be kind of an in-your-face move against the Pharisees. And it's interesting that the Pharisees have already known that this might happen. So they end up doing something with the mob. They do something with the mob. Maybe they paid him. I don't know what it is. Maybe they threatened him. I don't know.
This is the same crowd that less than a week before had been proclaiming him king. Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord as he came into the city.
Yeah. But they convince the mob because they know that Pilate is specially motivated to keep the peace here in Palestine. Yeah. And so if they can get the mob to say what they want, then he's more compelled to do what they want just in order to keep peace.
Well, and that makes me think that, you know, he probably would have gotten information about Jesus's relationship with the crowd, with the common people. And so which mob is he more afraid of? Is he afraid of Jesus' followers or is he afraid of the religious authorities?
Right.
And so here, I think that's kind of what this argument is about. He's trying to figure out how to keep the peace.
How do I maximize the peace
Is why it's really important that Jesus says to him, hey, if I were a king here, my followers would be fighting
you. We would be fighting.
But they're not.
Yeah, we would be fighting. So here is in his face, he's got to do something about this mob that's been so skillfully manipulated by the religious leaders who are envious of Jesus's popularity. That's what's going down in black and white right here. And he asks them, how about Barabbas? And they say no. Pilate says to him, then what do you want me to do with Jesus who's called the anointed one, the Christ, the Messiah? And they say, crucify him. Again, some words put in their mouths by the Pharisees, which, by the way, just as an aside, this crucifixion is a horribly repugnant thing to a Jewish mindset because it was a tool of the Romans. It was a tool of the Romans. And so for them to actually advocate for an execution tool of the Romans was just, it was an abomination to them. So they're really put up artificially when they when they say this. They're asking for a crucifixion. They would naturally, you know, prefer stoning from Old Testament traditions. But to actually use the most hated tool that the Romans use to pacify and to persecute the Jews and then to promote it for the death of Jesus is just a fascinating thing.
And it wasn't just that. Crucifixion was the means of execution that was used particularly for insurrectionists, for people who would not bow to the authority of Rome.
Yes.
And I think I was probably a teenager before I realized that Jesus was not the only person in the world who was ever crucified.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Thousands of people died at the hands of the Romans in this manner.
Right.
The Romans were experts in killing.
Yeah.
But this was the worst they could dish out.
And by the way, they did not invent crucifixion.
No.
But they sure refined
it. They made it an art form.
and it was used as a way to control the mobs in the country when there was uprisings and stuff like that. I mean, it was a public statement of, this will happen to you if you don't toe the line. It was a warning to the populace.
And it was extremely public.
Very public. Meant had to be public, in fact.
That's the whole point.
It wasn't just an execution. It was a display. It was a brutal execution as a warning to the general public.
And we'll talk about that a little bit more next week.
Yeah. And one thing I find fascinating before I read the rest of this is the fact that, you know, I've always imagined Barabbas being in a cell, being held someplace and hearing what's going on outside. Let's say he could not hear what Pilate was saying, but he could hear the crowd. Then if you look here at what the crowd was hearing, he would hear his name, Barabbas, and then right after that, he'd hear, let him be crucified. I always wondered.
Oh.
always wondered if he thought, oh, well, that's it. My goose is cooked. They're calling my name and they're calling for crucifixion.
Huh. That's interesting.
I wonder at the time when they brought him out to release him, where they thought he was a goner, and then all of a sudden you realize, oh, someone's taken my place. Interestingly enough, he could very well be the very first person on earth who understood the reality of Jesus taking his place.
Hmm. For his sins. You wonder if that had any effect on him at all.
Makes you wonder. It really makes you wonder.
I don't know. But, you know, the thing about Pilate, once he's convinced that he needs to release Barabbas, doesn't seem to bother with it. Because if Barabbas is such a terrible criminal and he gets in trouble again, they'll just catch him again.
They'll get him.
Right? They know they're going to follow him.
Yeah.
They know what he's up to.
Yeah.
Because his crime was insurrection. So you can bet they were keeping their eye on him.
Yeah, Mark says he was in prison with people who'd committed murder for the insurrection.
Right.
So he could have been one of those murderers. I mean, he's a bad guy. Well, let's finish this out.
Okay.
Verse 24.
So, when Pilate saw that he was gaining nothing, but rather that a riot was beginning, he took water and washed his hands before the crowd, saying, "I am innocent of this man's blood. See to it yourselves." And all the people answered, "His blood be on us and on our children."
Mm.
Then he released for them Barabbas, and having scourged Jesus, delivered him to be crucified.
Wow. There's a lot to say in this last section. But again, you know, he was scared of the riot. He wasn't really motivated to do the right thing, even though by his own admission, Pilate was convinced that Jesus was innocent.
Mm-hmm.
But he's not going to do the right thing. He needs to quell the riot that's starting up. And then in a way of a strange self-justification of proclaiming his own innocence in this, he washes his hand and says, "Look, I'm innocent of this man's blood. It's not my fault he's dying."
Yeah, he does that for his own benefit.
For his own benefit, exactly. For his own benefit. Such self-justification. It's just because he could have done something to stop this. It's an abrogation of justice. He knows the man is innocent, but he lets him be taken.
Well, he's more concerned about getting in trouble for letting a riot start.
Yeah.
Because he had been in trouble for letting riots start before.
That's right. And that's
he had been in trouble with Rome.
That's the biggest reason why he'll get in trouble if he doesn't keep the peace. What do you make of this incredible statement on the crowd's part? "I am innocent." I'm not innocent. "His blood be on us and on our children." Wow.
Well, you know, that's a way of saying we accept responsibility for this execution.
Right. Yeah. So he's saying, "I'm innocent of this man's blood." And they say, "Okay, his blood's on us."
Right.
So they're saying they're taking responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
But what a fascinating irony, again, it is, because if any of their children become believers in Christ, it is his blood that's on them that will save them. It's a fascinating twist of irony in how it's said.
You know, it's interesting that it's very clear here that it was this generation that rejected Jesus and chose a thief, a liar, a robber over the Son of God.
Mm-hmm.
But the Bible specifically, back in Deuteronomy, specifically forbids making the children pay for the sins of the parents.
Right.
Yeah. So we cannot hold the Jewish nation down to today responsible for the death of Jesus, right? This was a particular event at a particular time and place.
Yeah.
God knew it was going to happen. It was predetermined, Peter says, actually, to happen this way.
Right.
But, you know, throughout history, there have been some terrible things said about the Jews that they crucified Jesus. Not a correct understanding of what's happening.
And they often come back to this passage right here to support that.
Right.
In fact, if I'm not mistaken, you'll have to check me on this, but I think it's the Coptic Christians, the Egyptian Christians, who look at this passage and actually say that Pilate and his wife are saints. They're Christian saints because they tried to keep Jesus from being killed.
Well, I'm going to challenge our readers to do a little reading on this.
And I might be wrong. I might be wrong on that, but that's just
very easy to misunderstand this.
Yeah.
But again, just stay right in the context. This is a crazy political moment. The crowd is rising up. Pilate is going to have a mess on his hands that he cannot deal with. And he doesn't have any compunction about putting somebody to death.
Yeah.
So he says, just do it.
The reason I mentioned the Coptic thing is because of that era where they've always blamed the Jews. They say, look, you know, the Gentile Romans, they were trying to save Jesus. It's the Jews that got him killed.
Well,
now, that's a bad interpretation.
That's not exactly correct. But
That's a bad interpretation. Yeah. Before we finish, let's just talk a little bit about the scourging. He just says it in passing. That's not just a minor kind of violent abuse. It's often a fatal thing to go through, and if you survive it, if you survive it, you're at least in critical condition. You're very badly weakened. I mean,
well, often they didn't survive the scourging.
No, not at all. So the flaying, where you flay the back with these whips that have, you know, the bone and metal pieces in it, and you know, you're just short of going into shock.
This wasn't just a whipping.
Right. So this might be the explanation for why it is that Jesus died before the other two criminals did, because this was brutal.
But I don't want to end on that thought.
No.
Because what I want to end on is this contrast between Barabbas and Jesus.
Okay,
Barabbas
good.
Being a thief and a robber and a murderer. And going back to John 10:10, Jesus said, "The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy." Those are the very words that is used to describe Barabbas. "But I came that they might have life and might have it abundantly. I'm the good shepherd, and the good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep."
Yes.
So, you know, we have in this account here the people who should have recognized their good shepherd, who was ready to lay down his life for them, but choosing instead the thief, the liar, the robber, the murderer.
The one whose profession is taking people's lives.
That's right, yeah. In opposition to the one who is a life giver.
Yeah, what a profound picture of what the world does with Jesus. They prefer the one who steals, kills, and destroys, when they could instead place their lives in the hands of the one who brings life. Mm. I mean, it's all right there. Well, next time, instead of going directly to the crucifixion, the soldiers decide to kind of indulge themselves with a little entertainment, and they're going to haul Jesus inside out of public view, and they're going to have a mock worship of the King of the Jews.
And apparently this was common behavior for the Roman Roman guards.
So that's coming next before we get to the actual crucifixion and the story about bringing Jesus to the cross and the pain and suffering that he endured on our behalf, voluntarily. That story continues as we come back. We'll still be in chapter 27, so come back with us, and we'll talk about how the King of the Jews did indeed voluntarily die on our behalf. This is Jim.
And I'm Dorothy.
And we'll see you next time on More Than Ink.
There are many more episodes of this broadcast to be found at our website, morethaninc.org. And while you're there, take a moment to drop us a note. Remember, the Bible is God's love letter to you. Pick it up and read it for yourself, and you will discover that the words printed there are indeed more than ink.
I think we should start over.
Oh, you don't like that?
Nope.
Okay.
This has been a production of Main Street Church of Brigham City.